Net neutrality, the principle that all internet content should be available to everyone, is under siege. Yesterday's proposal by Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai to dismantle the regulations that ensure equal access to the internet is seen by many as a threat to free speech, seen by others as an end to what Chairman Pai calls micromanaging of the internet by the federal government. The announcement is sure to trigger a far-reaching debate, and Bert Lum, co-host of Hawaii Public Radio's weekly tech-focused talk show, Bite Marks Cafe, is on hand to help us make sense of it all. Good morning, Bert.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
All right. Why don't we start with a working definition of net neutrality as it exists today, Bert?
Well, in a nutshell, what has kind of evolved and resulted in net neutrality is the idea that if you are a content provider, and that content provider could be anything from a blogger to somebody doing audio content or perhaps video content, the traffic that you create as a way of providing that content is treated equally across all the different internet providers. So they don't necessarily have a way of prioritizing, video streaming versus, doing blogging. So everybody would get equal access to the bandwidth, and that's basically net neutrality. And what they first needed to do back in the Obama era was to, and that was with Tom Wheeler, who was the FCC chairman at the time, mm-hmm. they needed to redefine what an internet provider was. And, typically in Hawaii, the internet providers are like Hawaiian Telcom and Oceanic, which is now Time Warner, which is now Spectrum, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are the internet providers. But during the Obama era, they first needed to reclassify them as Title II. And instead of being sort of content providers, these internet providers, they were now classified as common carriers. So they were looked at as being more like telecom providers. And under the Title II, they basically put the ruling for net neutrality, which basically, restricted them from making any of this, sort of bandwidth prioritization so that they were prevented from doing that. They would equally deliver bandwidth or deliver content regardless of what kind of content it was.
Bert, from their perspective, they were hamstrung from making money, right?
Well, not really, because, a lot of the internet providers that are providing the connections to your computers wherever are selling bandwidth, right? So they're... You can get a residential connection, 10 meg, 50 meg. You can get a commercial connection, and that is being paid for by your monthly subscription to a service, right?
Right?
So you're getting internet service at 50 meg, and you're paying for that connection.
Mm-hmm.
So they're making money already for the bandwidth that they're providing you. What they want to do is they want to make with the new ruling that. The new FCC chairman is looking at proposing and passing today is the fact that now the internet providers can actually prioritize the types of content that are being delivered. And so in the case of, let's say, as an example, if you like to watch Netflix, but the internet provider is also could be a content provider because you're seeing mergers happen with AT&T and Time Warner, and they could easily be providing their own content.
Mm-hmm.
So they may be able to prioritize their own content over Netflix, and then you would have to pay more to get Netflix as a result of having a internet connection through AT&T.
Bert, who gains and who loses with this proposal?
So the people that gain are the big internet providers. So they're, what has happened over the years is that these internet providers have not only consolidated, but to get internet to your home or business, you have to be a pretty big player. So you have to be either a telecom provider or a cable provider. And with this ruling, they will be the ones that will benefit because they are not only providing you with the internet connection, but a lot of these large companies are also if you notice how some of these business mergers are taking place, they are also acquiring content. And so Verizon is acquiring content. AT&T is acquiring content. You know, Comcast is acquiring content. And they can now prioritize their content over somebody else's content, whereas before they were unable to do that with net neutrality.
It sounds as if the consumer is, no matter how it shakes out, going to be paying more for what he or she has come to identify as their expected internet service, right?
I think that's exactly true. So we are now typically used to the idea of paying a monthly rate, let's say for a 50 meg connection.
Mm-hmm.
But in the not too distant future, when this passes, there could be tiered services, and it might look very much like your, let's say, your internet or your cellular bill, where your cellular bill has multiple things on it, where it could be there's a text charge, there's a data charge, there's a voice minute charge.
Mm-hmm.
So it may not be equal to that, but you will see different tiers of services that may now be offered as a result of buying internet service from any of these large internet providers.
What do you think was Chairman Pai's motivation? I mean, as he referred to it as micromanaging of the internet. Is that coming from this sort of government off our backs kind of thinking?
So the people, you know, there's the big providers, and then there's the little content providers. So the, you know, in this big arena, right, a Netflix would be probably impacted by this because they're not an internet provider, so they will be impacted. It's not a matter of micromanagement. It's kind of, you know, I hate to say it, but it's sort of big business supporting big business, and this is going to continue to give the opportunity to large internet providers to basically figure out more ways to make money off of selling content. And I think the little content providers, and these, you know, in our minds, I mean, they may not be that little, but the Amazons, the Googles, the Netflixes, I mean, they're gonna suffer because they're not the internet provider, right? they're the content creators or providers.
Bert, tell me if this is an accurate description. I'm seeing a kind of cultural shift because you've been around the internet since the very beginning, and it's always been a very democratic means of reaching the whole world. You know, the little guy with the YouTube video becomes a star, right?
Because
he has equal access to everybody in the world, to the big, you know, the big provider. As you said, everybody's a provider. But that seems, you know, this seems like a real tectonic shift in how everything works.
Well, so what happens is, you know, the internet has been a great enabler for people to create content, and there have been successful businesses that have created a good you know, business around providing content. One example I'll bring up is I listened to a podcast called This Week in Technology by Leo Laporte, and they often, you know, if you look at what Leo has done, is they've created a pretty big network for audio content, not only audio but also video content, because they do a lot of all their content is streamed live via video, so they are a pretty major video content provider, but they are small considered, you know, if you compare them to, let's say, a Time Warner. Now, if there are tiered services that prioritize certain internet providers' content over, let's say, This Week in Tech, then the smaller business like This Week in Tech is going to suffer, because now people have to potentially pay more to get that content. So that's where I think, the micromanagement, management, I mean, there will be this innovation that they're talking about is innovating new ways to bill customers to get more money out of them as a result of removing net neutrality.
Well, that's it looks as if it's coming, doesn't it, Bert? We've got to go, but thanks very much.
Unfortunately, that seems to be the path, unless there's a real big vocal push to you know, stop the changing of the ruling.
Well, Bert, we'll have to see what happens. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Sure thing. Thanks, Chris.
Bert Lum is the co-host of Hawaii Public Radio's weekly tech-focused talk show, Bite Marks Cafe. You can find a link to the Federal Communication Commission's proposal on today's edition of the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, another information source, local news, is drying up. We'll hear from contributing editor Neil Milner. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're staying out of the rain and warming ourselves by the ovens. In the 1950s, a new Big Island bakery was opened with the sole focus of making delicious round, soft loaves of sweetbread. It quickly became an overnight island favorite. In 1963, the shop expanded and moved to King Street in Honolulu, where it was renamed King's Bakery. It, too, was an instant success. Freshly baked goods were marketed as being made with a key ingredient, the Aloha Spirit. By 1977, King's Bakery was so popular that locals were shipping King's sweetbread to friends and family on the mainland. As a result, the company capitalized on the growing demand and built a 24,000-square-foot bakery in Torrance, California. At this time, they were rebranded as King's Hawaiian Bakery. In our quiz for today, can you name the Hilo native who opened the store that started it all? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hey folks, Al Letson here, and riddle me this. What do Roseanne Barr, the Trump presidential campaign, fake news sites run by Macedonian teenagers, and Russian Twitter accounts all have in common?
Pizzagate.
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 That's next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
This evening at 7, right after Bite Marks Cafe.
If all politics is local, as we are often reminded, then the public's understanding of the democratic process largely depends on local news coverage, and that coverage is in serious decline. As print outlets continue to cut back and shut down, many pin their hopes on news websites, but those too are shutting down. It's a trend with wide-reaching implications for our ability to sustain a government that's responsive to the needs and wishes of its people. Contributing editor Neil Milner is with us in our studio with a look at what's been happening to local news outlets and how the public feels about it. Hi, Neil. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We've been hearing this about newspapers for a while, but it just because of newspaper, I mean, it's not only newspapers that are fading from the scene, is it?
No, it's really gone. If you look at the economic side, which is the most obvious side, but not necessarily, it's not the only side, but let's look at that first. The number of people being able to work in the newspaper industry has declined precipitously. The number of newspapers has declined precipitously. If you look at websites, there's not much interest in local news. But so the first issue is that the decline of what would be the conventional sources of local news. And this particular bit of research, the person who wrote about it, wasn't stimulated by a recent decline, but mentioned it. And that is The Gothamist, which was set up to cover local news, website coverage of local news in five different cities. Mm-hmm. That closed down. There was a threat of unionization. They weren't making enough money, whatever. So that was symbolically, if not materially, a very important way to try to counter this, and that's gone.
The whole idea of how democracy works, and I refer to that Tip O'Neill quote about all politics being local, because the idea being that you get your engagement with society by worrying about what's going on right in your neighborhood, who's picking up your trash, and then your engagement in the larger aspects of society starts from there.
Yeah, I want to come back to that because I think that's really very crucial, and I think there's something going on that makes that much more difficult to take place. What we now know, and this is the other part, this is the non-economic part of the decline of local news. First of all, the internet has not, it's created a lot of opportunities for people to look at news, but people really don't. The average person doesn't use the internet for news. Mm-hmm. You can imagine what it's used for, but it's not used for news. Those people who do use it for news, an increasingly smaller percent goes on a site that has local news. Mm-hmm. And of those, a large percentage of those are simply linking onto a news story, a conventional news story. It's not additional news. So the orientation, according to surveys, is clearly much more toward national news. People who pay attention to news start paying attention to national news. And you're right that has two effects. One effect, and I'll come back to the one that you raised. One effect is that it actually makes people more ignorant about what's going on in elections. One of the interesting bits of research here is Danny Hayes and Jennifer Lawless, both political scientists, did this very careful study looking at a panel of people in a couple of congressional elections in certain areas. And they found that there was a correlation between the decline in local news and the degree to which people knew something about the candidates. So you really are beginning to see, at least tentatively, an effect between the decline and its effect on democracy. So that's one. You want me to go on and talk
Please.
About Okay. here's the other side of it, I think. What we've assumed, and much of this is mythical, is that people need to pay attention, that people do pay attention. That's the heart of democracy. Mm-hmm. Well, we know a whole lot about how people actually think, and most people don't reach that kind of standard. But let's look at what's happening now. There is much more, because of the Trump administration and all the stuff that goes on, many people who pay attention to politics are paying more and more attention to the national news. And so, in a sense, one of the bad effects of the Trump administration, and I tell this to Trump haters all the time, is you're letting those people define your political world. And your political world is also a local political world. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of things get done. That's where your everyday contact with politics are, as you said before. And I think that this kind of concern about what Donald Trump is doing is at the expense of other kind of political issues.
Well, as the press gets derided from the top on down, It's a reminder that, you know, the founders of the country had a free press built into the whole notion of how the country was constructed, right? That it was assumed that people, that every town of a decent size would have a newspaper and that people would be informed. So when they vote for their council member, their state senator, it's an informed vote. And that's kind of a bedrock assumption.
It is a bedrock assumption, and like a lot of assumptions about how democracy works, it's greatly mythical. But there was some element of truth to it. If you lived in a town, I don't know, Oconto, Wisconsin, yeah, or Hilo or whatever, there was somebody writing a newspaper that talked about local stuff. I lived in a town in which there was always these kinds of things, and a local radio station every day would announce births and deaths. Mm-hmm. It's to someone who doesn't live there, it's cheesy. But on the other hand, you get the nuts and bolts stuff that you're not likely to pick up and that you increasingly don't pick up in newspapers because they don't have the coverage. You don't have someone necessarily covering the local beat.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, what kind of long-term effects do you see for that? You know?
Well, I mean, certainly the most obvious long-term effect is that newspapers are going to continue to decline, and you can just look at the Star Advertiser, which just went through another series of layoffs, and they're clearly losing some experienced and good people. I think the other long-term effect is that the kinds of attempts to make people more interested in the world around them in a kind of concrete sort of way is going to become even more difficult. I've talked about this on the show before. I've been very much impressed or depressed with the research that shows the extraordinary difference between the myth of democracy and how people actually behave. People mm-hmm. behave, they don't, they look for information that supports them. All of these kinds of things would suggest that you can't really build the democracy on the basis of these theories about informed citizens, because informed citizens, there aren't that many around. At the same token, this is, I think, nibbling away at whatever kind of informed citizenry we have. That it's, I think that when you have something like this, you're losing a source of information. You're making it more likely that people are going to turn to the highly polarized national news, and that it's going to play a part in exaggerating the polarization.
Does this decline make the public easier to manipulate?
Well, you know what? The yes and no. The public is not that hard to manipulate in this sense. All of us turn toward people we trust. Mm-hmm. In order to get most of our information. It's as much about trust and tribalism as it is about looking neutrally at some kind of information. That's just the basis of the way our minds tend to work. But again, if it's going to make it more likely that you're going to silo, and if it's going to make it more likely that you're looking toward the national news as a kind of orientation, I think in some ways it's going to make people more ignorant, or it's going to make people less concerned about the real world around them in their neighborhood, in their schools. And I've said before that in times of national polarization, one of the ways that you can do politics is at the grassroots concrete level, where ideology is less important and where you're more likely to be able to find people who are different than you politically, but that you can work with.
But you have to know what's going on.
You have to know what's going on. You know, we can't be overly impressed by the amount of political knowledge that most people have.
No, that can't.
And then most people, including the interesting research shows that the more you know, the more you pay attention to politics, the better you are at spinning it in order to agree with what you say.
I'm going to have to ponder that one.
Yes, we can talk some more about that sometime.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
Sure.
Neil Milner is the Conversation's contributing editor of our regular segment on The Long View. You can find links to more information about that segment on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, why Bob Dylan matters. A Dylanologist joins us to make the case. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR. If your time
to you is worth this afternoon at 2, following the world. Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Or the time.
Randall Saito's escape to the mainland last week has focused attention yet again on the workings of the Hawaii State Hospital, with one state senator calling for additional security personnel and expedited construction of a new facility for high-risk patients. Another state senator is saying that project should not be rushed. Questions continue to surface about the escape and about the ways that facility operates, as political and opinion editor Chad Blair tells us in today's reality check from Civil Beat. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Chris. Happy Thanksgiving Eve.
Yes, indeed. This is not the first time we've had our attention drawn toward the Hawaii State Hospital, is it?
No, not at all. And with Josh Green, who's a medical doctor, represents the Big Island. Remember, he co-chaired that investigation committee from the Senate, along with Clayton He, just 3 years ago. Of course, they were focused on a lot of things, primarily patients actually abusing staff. But he feels he has something to add here. And you mentioned doubling security. Yeah, he wants that. Maybe have the sheriff's deputies involved as well. In terms of expediting that new 144-bed facility, he'd like to have that done a year earlier. Right now, December 2020, about 3 years from now, is when that's scheduled. He says maybe the governor should declare a state of emergency. And then one other thing, he's saying, you know, let's freeze the admission of highly assaultive patients or people with histories of violence. That would seem to apply to Saito. We actually have four such patients on the mainland. Don't send those back. Maybe send similar patients from Honolulu, from Kaneohe, rather, the facility, to the mainland. Those are the things that Josh Green is calling for.
Where do we send them on the mainland?
There's a facility, and as you know, we send hundreds, not more, to Arizona. But there's a private contractor that helps take care of that. It's in Louis Kanea's story, and forgive me for not knowing the exact location, whether it's Ausland, Arizona. But you mentioned another senator said, whoa, slow down on expediting the building of that facility. That's Jill Takuda, who actually was chair of Ways and Means when $160 million was appropriated just in the last year or so to make that happen. That's Takuda's district.
Yeah.
She's saying, wait a minute, we have a history of screwing up big projects in this state. Why are we rushing this? I should add that both Jill Takuda and Josh Green are running for the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor.
Well, that does muddy the waters a little bit.
Not that politics is involved. I believe Green and Takuda are quite serious about this, but you know, certainly these are the kind of things that get attention in the media.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind, Chad, is that that's an awful lot of investment for a couple of hundred patients.
It really is. And one thing that Green recommended, or rather that the hospital has already undergone, Green actually met with hospital administrators earlier this week. But apparently what they're doing is they are putting up more fencing, and they are suspending what's known as on-ground escorted and off-ground unescorted privileges for patients that would presumably have caught someone like Randall Saito. So that's encouraging. And as we all know, Governor Ige has asked Doug Chin, the attorney general, to investigate. There's, a half a dozen investigators looking into that. So it does seem that the state is taking action to try and make sure something like this doesn't happen again.
It's a rich subject for investigation, given that he was able to charter a plane, make phone calls, make it all the way to the mainland, right?
I mean, I'm telling you, they got to make a movie out of this. It's not going to be good for Hawaii, but it's a heck of a story. And
who
it's not
would believe
over yet.
It, Chad?
Not me.
Thanks very much. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Be sure to join me and my co-host Frances Lamb for this year's Turkey Confidential. It's 2 hours of culinary triage on the day you need it most, Thanksgiving. We'll take your calls, and we're going to have some pretty impressive food friends stopping by, too. Don't miss it. That's Turkey Confidential on Thanksgiving Day from 8 p.m.
Thursday morning at 10.
No one can say how many native Hawaiian plants have been driven to extinction by habitat loss, invasive animals like pigs and rats, and diseases. But there are many, and some like Phyllostegia kaalaensis a member of the mint family, survive only in greenhouses, closely monitored by scientists. UH Manoa botany professor Anthony Amond and his team have found a way to transplant wild microbes from healthy related plants, making a fragile organism into a much healthier plant. Their research could open up possibilities for the rehabilitation of other endangered plants, and Dr. Amond is with us in our studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
What's the principle involved here? What exactly are you doing?
Well, so if you take a look at a plant and you hold it up to the light, what you see is a lot of green.
Mm-hmm.
What you don't see are the thousands of fungi and bacteria that are living inside that plant,
mm-hmm.
And that are providing a lot of functions for that plant. They're providing chemicals that help defend against pathogens and pests, and they're helping that plant take up water and nutrients as well. So what happens is if a plant is deprived of those microbes via something like a fungicide application or antibacterial application,
mm-hmm.
They lose the ability to survive in the wild. Because there are so many of these threatened endangered plants that are surviving only in greenhouses, managers have to maintain those plants alive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're real susceptible to pathogens. So they apply fungicides weekly. In the case of Phyllostegia caulensis, they're only surviving in the greenhouse. They can't keep them alive without applying these fungicides.
They just wouldn't survive. They don't have the resistance.
Exactly. They'll pick up a fungal pathogen within about 30 days and die.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then is these plants are kept alive, but they don't have any of their beneficial microbes. So when we try and plant them out into the forest, they have a real hard time defending themselves against pests and obtaining the nutrients and water. So what we tried to do was borrow a page from microbial transplants like people are doing in humans now, where if people have gut issues, they'll take microbes from a healthy individual and help restore their natural microbial functions. And we wanted to see if we could do that with plants. So we took leaves from wild relatives that were growing in the forest, ground them up in a blender, and sprayed them on the plants of these captive Phyllostegia.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that that was really effective. It helped these plants fend off these fungal pathogens and actually allowed them to survive in the wild. So now we have four individual plants that are growing out in the Waianae's that have never been subject to any sort of fungicide application. They just have their wild microbes, and they're doing great.
Somehow I thought it was going to be much more complicated than what you just described, which is getting a closely related plant, grinding it up, and spraying it on the leaves.
And that's sort of the beauty of this application,
yeah.
is that we work real hard in our labs to try to pick apart the different components of diversity in nature. But sometimes just embracing that diversity is the best approach.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in these greenhouses where they have so many threatened and endangered plants, keeping things clean and sterile is imperative. They're absolutely careful to make sure that they don't introduce anything, you know, dirtier that could cause disease to these plants. But it turns out maybe that's part of the problem, and that by introducing this whole complexity of microbes, we can actually help the plants to survive.
The trouble with the fungicidal approach is that it allows the plant, or it forces the plant to exist only in that what you described as a kind of a hothouse environment, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this Phyllostegia plant that was that we wrote about in this paper that came out last week only survives in really remote ridges in the Waianae mountain range.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a several hours hike or a helicopter ride to get to these places where that plant formerly grew. So you can imagine if this plant were still dependent on people flying in and spraying it with fungicide once a week,
yeah.
We wouldn't have much of a chance at keeping this plant alive. So giving it this head start through applying microbes is really a great way forward. And we're looking forward to trying this approach on several other endangered plants as well.
That's what I was just thinking about, was these principles here would seem to be principles could be applied to in a lot of other plants.
Yeah, one of our projects now in our lab is looking at ohia rust, which is attacking certain varieties of ohia as well as endemic genus Eugenia and mountain apple and rose apple as well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you've seen some of these mountain apples that are just bright orange covered with fungus.
Yeah.
So we're trying something very similar. We're going out into the wild. We're finding healthy individuals, isolating fungi from their leaves, and then seeing if those help attack this rust.
I'm wondering how broadly this principles can be applied, because some of them, some of the things you described, can also describe issues in human health, right? we've come to understand that the human body is actually a host to thousands of organisms.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great inspirations for this project is that we've seen a lot of success with fecal transplants. And I know it sounds gross, but it's really effective, especially for people that suffer from something like irritable bowel syndrome. It's caused by a proliferation of one or two species of bacteria that get into a gut and just grow and reproduce and exclude other species of bacteria. And you can almost reboot the human gut by taking microbes from a healthy individual and getting those to establish in your gut. Now, people have suggested that you can use this approach for all sorts of other ailments as well. But we found that the applications are somewhat limited. Just because you take healthy microbes and put them in your gut doesn't mean that they're going to stay there and survive, right? So there's only certain circumstances where you can use an approach like this. And so with plants, we're limited by the same types of parameters, and we're still figuring out what are some of the useful applications and what applications really aren't possible at this point.
Sounds as if the science is kind of young in this area.
Oh, absolutely. I think we didn't really realize the diversity of microbes that were on and inside these plants until fairly recently when we could start to use genome sequencers to look at the DNA. And that really opened up a big black box of a world that we didn't know was out there.
What's on your wish list to find out about the contents of that big black box?
Well, we know that Hawaii is facing an extinction crisis right now. We know that we're losing a lot of our plants and birds and insects. Presumably, we're also losing a lot of our fungi and bacteria at the same time, but these are so little documented that the rate of extinction is really a question mark, and anybody that tells you otherwise is probably trying to sell you something or lying to you. So I would love to find out where are these hot spots of diversity and how we can conserve some of our Hawaiian microbes and how we can leverage those microbes to help save some of the plants and animals that are important to us.
You see that as pretty hopeful?
I do. I do. I think this is a great way forward.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Anthony Amond is an associate professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Department of Botany. Head over to the Conversation Facebook page to find more information on his research.
Hi, I'm Santiago Torres from Santa Barbara, California. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Today we ask you to name the man credited with Hawaiian sweetbread's creation. The popular baked treat had its origins on the Big Island, and after a few years of extreme popularity, the Shapa was produced, relocated to Honolulu, where it continued its success. 14 years after that move, King's Hawaiian sweetbread was so popular, locals and tourists alike were sending and bringing the bread to the mainland for family and friends. This customer network gave the company the motivation it needed to build a factory in Torrance, California. And as its popularity grew there, a storefront was built for the factory, but it still wasn't producing enough to meet demands. In the 1990s, a second 40,000-square-foot bakery was built, and to think it all began as a small and local Roberts Bakery in Hilo, started by Robert Tyra. And Lonnie from Mililani knew the answer to that. Congratulations, Lonnie. You're today's quiz winner. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The so-called gig economy, a disruption of traditional ways of doing business, is changing the way we do a great many things, how we get around town, where we stay when we travel, and now with Uber Eats, the way we get our dinner. Your smartphone is not just for pizza anymore, as Jonathan Wong, author of Driving Profits and Making Bank, is about to explain to us. He's with us in our studio. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me here.
It's good to have you here. I've been noticing you since you come in. Your smartphone is never far away, right? And you use it for a lot of things that, you know, I'm still to the point. I just use mine to make phone calls. It sits unused for, you know, most of the day. But you've adapted to a completely different application of that gizmo, haven't you?
You know, and I think for most people within my age group and under, you know, we are tied to our mobile devices. We use it for every single thing. So making calls, sending messages to our friends and loved ones. And as you kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, getting services through our phone.
That range of services seems to be expanding almost daily, Jonathan.
It's crazy, Chris. You know, you talked about getting rides, and, you know, within our current on-demand economy, you'd be surprised at the types of things you can get through your phone on an on-demand basis. So besides rides, you can order food, you can have somebody pick up your groceries for you, you can have somebody walk a dog for you, you can get an on-demand therapist through your phone. And, you know, all of these represent services that we as consumers can get, but it also represents, you know, income-making opportunities for people who want to get into some of these opportunities.
It also represents a threat to more traditional ways of doing things where you, you know, if you want to start a restaurant, you lease a building and commit yourself to, a lengthy lease, and you've got to pay that that nut each month, and you've got to make sure that people physically come to your facility. It's a whole different way of thinking, isn't it?
It is. It is, definitely. You know, for, you know, with regard to the on-demand delivery services, you know, food delivery is, you know, it's a pretty old industry. You know, we think about, you know, the Pizza Hut delivery boy bringing a pizza to your house.
Right.
The occasional Chinese restaurant that did employ delivery people. Nowadays, you know, with services like Uber Eats and Postmates, you know, with the push of a button, you know, you can get an order from just about any restaurant that's part of these services. So,
yeah. Do you see a lot of people your age, of your generation, you know, coming out of college and finding there aren't that many jobs as they thought there were going to be? More and more of them creating their own ways of making a living using this gig economy?
Definitely. You know, we've seen it on the mainland for several years, and, you know, these opportunities are slowly making their way to Hawaii. You know, Uber and Lyft have been around for several years now. Postmates, which is another on-demand delivery service, they've been around for a while.
What's Postmates?
They're a on-demand delivery service, so they're the complement. You know, if you think of Uber and Lyft as ride-hailing, Postmates was the first on-demand delivery service for food, as well as things that, you know, you could get from like a 7-Eleven or like a Long's, you know, if you need, you know, somebody to go pick up your meds or your toothbrush, you ran out of soap. You know, instead of you yourself going down, you just hit a button, order it from there, a guy brings it to you. So that was Postmates. And then, you know, Uber ventured into delivery business with Uber Eats. So, you know, they're copying and diversifying into the Postmates business model.
Let's just say I have a bunch of groceries and maybe I'm indisposed, unable to get them to my home. Say I've got $50 worth of groceries, you know, a couple of large bags. What's it going to cost to get that delivered, say, within a 10-mile radius?
You know, for that, that's through the Instacart app. So Instacart is the delivery on-demand service that they have. You know, the delivery fees, I believe, are around maybe about the $10 mark. You know, don't fully quote me on that.
Just ballpark, you know.
Yeah, ballpark figure. Yeah, so, you know, not that, you know, it's not completely unaffordable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you factor in your time and your gas to get somewhere, you know, it's not bad.
Does it make the person giving those deliveries, can he or she make a living?
You know, with Instacart, I believe so. You know, grocery delivery, generally speaking, pays better than food delivery. So, you know, a grocery delivering service, you know, somebody could viably make a living, or at least a very good part-time income.
Yeah.
You know, I would never fully recommend ever putting all of your eggs in one basket.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's just not a good thing.
Sure.
But, you know, for a lot of people, you know, they'll diversify their income earning opportunities. You know, I know a lot of Lyft drivers and Uber drivers who also work for Instacart. You know, so you have a couple of balls that you're juggling in the air. Ultimately, you know, it's whatever comes to your phone is what you respond to first. And, you know, you take on so many gigs throughout a day, you know, you could earn, you know, up to $200, $300 a day as a gig worker.
Well, that's going to have some appeal to quite a few people, especially, you know, I'm thinking a student starting out trying to find that first job after college.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I would recommend these opportunities to just about anyone, whether, you know, you're looking to just earn some extra bucks on the side, or if you are having trouble securing a regular job, you know, there's a lot of appeal to the gig economy because, you know, you're not tied to a certain schedule. You know, as an independent contractor, you work at your convenience.
Yeah.
So, you know, like for me, you know, I'm self-employed. But, you know, if things are slow on my other business, you know, because I am an independent contractor of Uber, Lyft, Instacart, Postmates, WAG, that's the on-demand dog walking service.
Oh, that's a new one on me.
Yeah.
Great name.
Yeah. Because I'm an independent contractor of all of those services, you know, my phone is beeping all the time saying, hey, would you like to, you know, give this person a ride? Would you like to walk this dog? Would you like to go pick up from this restaurant? Would you want to go pick up somebody's groceries from Safeway? You know, you add all of that up enough throughout a day, you're doing pretty well.
So you just find out, say, as Uber Eats just started out. So
yeah.
You would then maybe email Uber Eats and say, I'm available to be a driver for you?
So all of these, you know, services have an onboarding process. You sign up to be an independent contractor with them, and then you go through their small training process. Typically, you just watch a YouTube video that trains you.
Uh-huh.
You consent to a background check.
They do a background check.
Yeah, all of them do a background check. It's to keep, you know, all the users safe, basically.
Well, that's comforting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You don't want just any stranger coming into your house to walk your dog or give you a ride or drop off your groceries. And then from there, you download the app. And then typically how all of these things work is for Uber and the delivery services, when you want to accept jobs, you turn on the app to say, hey, I'm available to take a job. And then, you know, when you're tired of it or when you have other things to do, you turn off the app saying, okay, I'm not taking any jobs right
now. This is going to have a lot of appeal to a lot of working people.
Yeah, it does.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah.
Jonathan Wong is a business consultant, author of the book Driving Profits and Making Bank. You can learn more about him and his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Kalava Korea from the Smithsonian's Asian Pacific American Center. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or on Google Play.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host, Derek Malama, joins us to look at events going on that are a little under the radar. And usually, Derek, we talk about things going on tomorrow, but we're going to skip a day, aren't we?
That's right, because the conversation is off for Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Right, okay. We'll talk about Aloha Friday events right now. At UH Manoa, this Friday, you can seek enlightenment through a piece of bamboo.
Uh-huh.
And we're talking about the shakuhachi, the bamboo flute my Japanese grandfather used to play this.
Is that right?
Yes,
it's
yes.
It's got a great sound, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. And Christopher Yome Blaisdell will present a concert of traditional and contemporary meditation pieces performed on the shakuhachi. And it's at Friday, 7:30 p.m. in the Choral Room next to Orvis Auditorium.
And enlightenment will soon follow, right?
Mm-hmm. especially for the holiday season. Yeah. You know, we all need that.
Yeah, very much. And there's a new farmer's market in Waimanalo on every Friday. That's new to me.
It's called Momona Nights. Momona meaning abundant or plentiful. And this farmer's market features produce, vendors, live music, and keiki activities. It's from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at the Waimanalo Market Co-op, 41-1029 Kalani Anaole Highway.
Right on the main drag there.
Yes, yes.
And there's six art studios in Volcano Village are hosting a tour and sale over this long weekend.
Meet the artists in their studios and see artwork in a wide variety of media. The artwork will be on display and available for purchase at six studios and galleries in the heart of the village. And it's happening Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Maps to the artists' studios will be available at local businesses and galleries in Volcano Village on the Big Island.
Terrific, Derek. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
The White House says current corporate taxes will wind up giving workers a pay raise. At least one.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Enjoy your Thanksgiving. And tomorrow, HPR 1 will carry the two-hour special, Turkey Confidential. It starts at 10 a.m. That'll be preempting our show, but we'll be back with the conversation on Friday.